Thank you, Mr. Kartika, and that was beautiful. I won't say anything more because you've said it all. But I would like to say to you and to these three dear doctors, it takes goodness to see goodness. I would like, before I say anything about my guru, to read a paper which I have written called Why I Love My Guru, Paramahansa Yogananda. I just finished it today. Friendship, Yogananda used to say, is the most rewarding human experience, being free from any compulsion. Even in a mother's love, there is a certain natural compulsion, the thought of her children as hers. Were her child to die and be reborn next door, it is not certain she would have the same love for it, even if she felt for it a certain natural affection. Noble an institution as friendship is, however, it was not until I met my guru that I came to understand its higher octaves. As a divine friend, he was perfection itself. For friendship should uplift, and that is something it does not always do. So long as it is between egos, it may only strengthen the ego. There is much to be said all the same for human friendship, even when its benefit is primarily to the ego. Experiments have been done on plants to show that when even a plant is given love, it flourishes, whereas if love is denied it, its growth may be stunted. Moreover, if hate is directed toward it, it may even wither and die. Friends are like that. Even if they offer only ego balm, a healthy ego is much more to be desired than a crippled, sickly one that is forever unsure of itself, inwardly wilting and cringing from everything and everybody. Though much might be said, then, of the possible negative influences of ordinary human friendship, basically, it is something all human beings need. I have in many respects in this life been fortunate, perhaps in nothing so much as in two inborn qualities: never to be influenced in my opinions of others by their opinion of me, and never to feel tempted to justify myself, not even to myself, when I knew I was in the wrong. These qualities have been my strength. I think that true friendship must spring not from need, but from inner strength, for in this way it can be purely giving. A danger of friendship lies in the fact that friends want you to agree with them. Bad friends, consequently, want you to agree with and support them in their errors. As my guru put it, if you try to talk to them of higher things, they may reply jovially, "Oh, come on, have a drink." This is friendship. Too often, in other words, a person's apparent friends are actually the enemies of his highest interests. As the Bhagavad Gita puts it, when the self is the friend of the self, it is its greatest friend. But when the self is the enemy of the self, it is its greatest enemy. A true friend is one who helps you to befriend that higher self. He supports everything that is best and truest for your highest welfare. He sympathizes with you and tries to understand your point of view, and will not condemn you hastily for any disagreement, nor separate himself from you in sympathy because of any divergence of opinion. There is dignity in such a relationship, and mutual respect, and yes, a shared sense of fun also, for an ability to laugh kindly together is one way of sharing trust, confidence, and mutual support. I had not the advantage as a child and youth of many close friendships, for I was never in one place long enough to form them. I lived in Teleagin, Romania, true, till I was 9, but childhood friendships are not often deep, and many of my friends lived there just as temporarily as we did, until their fathers were shifted abroad by their company. I spent a year and a half in Switzerland, where I was ill most of that time. 6 months followed in Bucharest, then 2 years at school in England. We moved to America in 1939, where I spent a year at Hackley School near Tarrytown, New York, 2 years at Kent School in Connecticut, a year at high school, at Scarsdale High, 2 years at Haverford College, a year and a half at Brown University, a year in Charleston, and then Master and SRF, 14 years with the latter, 60 so far with the former. Rod, my best friend in college, had a twofold influence on me, one for the good and the other for the not so good. He helped me to regain my self-confidence when I needed it. Unfortunately, though brilliant, he was intellectually proud. I became infected with that pride. My intellect being perhaps my strong point, it also became my weakest link. If, through all the years that followed, my one truest and best of all possible friends was always my guru, Paramhansa Yogananda. He was true in every respect, the human guide as much as the divine, the human quite as much as the divine. It is true that I couldn't joke with him in the familiar way friends like to enjoy with one another. I was too young then, to be more than always in deep awe of him. For me, to be with him was like being in the presence of God himself. Yet I used to ask him endless questions, more perhaps than any other disciple, and he answered me freely, for he wanted me to understand. Again, he would joke with me, and I, who have always had a keen sense of humor, would joke back. Yet always I held him also, a little at a distance, never quite confident of myself in his presence. That much said, however, he was with me, not at all the kind of stern disciplinarian some of his disciples have described. He was kind, forgiving, endlessly and deeply understanding, supportive of my and of our human failings and feelings, not indeed of the failings themselves, but of us. He showed himself ever anxious to help us to mature and grow out of every delusion. Once he scolded me for my involvement in a confrontation where I had felt righteously indignant. It took me a little while to adjust mentally to this volte face, or about face. But I said to him the next day, "Please, Master, scold me more often." Looking at me deeply and with heartfelt understanding, he answered, "I understand, but that isn't what you need. You need more devotion." He also encouraged me in every little gain, even though no one else would have even noticed him doing so. One day he said to me lovingly, "Keep on with your devotion. Just see how dry your life is when you depend on intellect." And one time, feeling intensely my separation from him, I went to Encinitas, where he was visiting, on purpose to see him. As soon as we met, he responded warmly, "I have missed you, Walter." That evening, David Smith, another disciple, involved us in worldly chatter, and my devotion slipped. When I saw Master the next day, he tugged my hair lightly and reminded me with the same loving smile, though with a hint of reproof, "I have missed you." It pains me when I hear people say sternly, "Master wouldn't have approved of that. Master couldn't tolerate disorder. Master was very strict." These things were always said to justify the disciples' own lack of kindness, sympathy, and simple charity. But I remember one time, I've quoted elsewhere in these essays, he came into the monk's dining room and found it most embarrassingly in utter chaos. His only comment was, "Well, it might be worse." In his treatment of the other disciples, I never saw him speak to them harshly. In fact, I wonder whether their impression of harshness didn't come from their own rebellious egos. The few times he scolded me, I saw only regret in his eyes for having to speak to me in that way. It was purely for my benefit. There was a period in Diamata's discipleship, she told me, when he had scolded her almost daily. She resented it, especially because his manner was so different then from what he had shown when she first came. One evening she prayed, "From now on, Divine Mother, I will direct my love first to you." When she went indoors for his blessing, he tapped her lightly on the head and murmured approvingly, "Very good." The scolding stopped. He had wanted to break her of excessively human attachment. With those who were not his disciples, he was affability itself, kindly, warm, accepting, wholly forgiving. I remember one time, I mentioned this occasion in my book, The Path, at a public function, a man from India was a bit tipsy and treated Master with a kind of familiarity no one else would ever dreamed of, putting his arms around Master, laughing jovially, and I don't know what else. Debbie, a Bengali disciple, ridiculed the man in Bengali, a language unknown to this Indian, to Master for his inebriation. "Don't," Master scolded him. He saw in this man the full dignity of a human being, not someone who, in his drunkenness, had lost that dignity. Another time, as he was entering a hotel, a drunken stranger came up to him, embraced him, and cried, "Hello, Jesus Christ!" "Hello," Master responded affably, and gave him a touch of the inner bliss he himself was feeling. "Say, what are you drinking?" demanded the man. "It has a lot of crick in it," Master replied. He then touched this man on the forehead, leaving him sober, though rather bewildered. These are stories I have shared before. Here is another one. A member of the Indian community came to Mount Washington with Ambassador Binoy R. Shen just days before Master left his body. This Indian lived in Los Angeles and had devoted years to persecuting Master by talking against him. At one moment during that visit, when the two of them were alone together, Master said to him, "Remember, I will always love you." Herbert Fried, a brother disciple, overheard the Master's words. A photograph of Master taken at that moment shows the visitor's expression. It shows a mixture of emotions, wonder, shame, perhaps horror at his own pettiness. For those who understand the inwardness of that moment, it is a dramatic photograph. It was this episode, incidentally, that gave me the inspiration for my one-act play, The Jewel in the Lotus. Master simply accepted all persons as they were, with never a breath of criticism, but ever lovingly. It offers and surprised me how total his acceptance was. People whom I myself might have turned away from with distaste, Master treated kindly, often with a gentle but always dignified smile. Not everyone by any means understood him. I'll never forget Master's neighbor at 29 Palms, when that man gave Norman, another disciple, his opinion of Master. Master used to share fruits with this man. One day the fellow said, "You know, he's a little..." He made a circular movement by his temple, indicating he's considered Yogananda a little touched in the head. But he added almost fervently, "He's got a heart of gold." He was a true friend to everybody. He saw all as his very own. That is why, wherever he went, he always found friends eager to help him. Yet, when someone came to him and asked to be accepted as his disciple, he saw his responsibility as a friend to be the highest type of friend he could be to that person. In this sense, he might be compared to a divine fisherman, never letting the line get too tight, but if it slackened, testing it to see how hard he could reel it in without letting it break. He was infinitely kind to us, supportive, gentle, humorous, one with us in friendship, and ever completely loving. Yet he was careful always to turn our minds and aspirations toward our own highest potential in God. Never did I see him come down from that high purpose for any gratification of his own. And always I saw in his calm gaze a complete absence of ego motive, of any impulse either to act or react. People, perhaps men especially, who have no personal motivation, are often misunderstood by others, bound as almost all human beings are by personal desires. Master had many self-styled enemies who fancied they saw in him someone dark, scheming for subtle hidden ends, which he was not frank enough to admit openly, and therefore all the more sinister. They feared his very strength. Their fears, however, were entirely projections of their own dark natures. Perhaps it was that strength also which made some of the disciples think of him as unrelentingly harsh. Otherwise, I can't imagine how anyone saw him as anything but a strong bulwark, ever supportive of our true needs. No, I think those disciples, too, simply hadn't the humility or the sensitivity to see in him the truest divine friend they would ever have. Only consider his poem, God's Boatman. He promised in that poem to come back, if need be, a trillion times, quote, as long as one stray brother sits weeping by the wayside. Think of it. There was no personal need for him to return to this material plane. He came here out of a purely selfless desire to bring others out of delusion and lead them to God's kingdom. How many times, I have often wondered, has he returned here already in perfect freedom? I have good reason to believe that he has been coming back for many thousands of years, always with the same purpose and with the same universal love. He himself often told us, I killed Yogananda long ago. Only God lives in this temple now. And I heard him declare also, I was freed many lifetimes ago. Think of it. The vast majority of souls who achieve oneness with God are satisfied never to come out again. The divine bliss is too perfectly satisfying to them. They've suffered enough in attaining it. All they want now is eternal and complete rest in him. What did our Guru want from us? Nothing. Nothing, that is, but our own highest good. Could any friend be more perfect, more dear, more wonderful than that? He said to me when I met him, I give you my unconditional love. No treasure, surely, could be greater than that sacred promise. He has fulfilled it in countless ways. More and more through the years, I have found him mentally guiding, leading me toward inner freedom, filling me with inner bliss. He hasn't made the way easy, unless indeed we consider that every hardship has turned out in the end to be a supernal blessing. No, I can think of no experience in my life that has not ended in sweetness, in an expansion of love, and in deep gratitude. Forgiveness for wrongs, hurts, betrayals, tests. All I can say is, what tests? What betrayals? What hurts? What wrongs? They were never wrongs personally to me. In all my dealings with Master when he was in the body, I always knew he was on my side, not against anyone or anything, but supportive of me in my struggles toward perfection. He responded supportively to my least thought. If I was wrong, he said so in such a way that only I, if we were in a group, could know what he was talking about. He never blurted out anything. All his words were carefully measured so as to be as understandable and acceptable as possible. There was, as I said, a dignity about him that was completely innate and natural. He was indeed a king among men, and I think most people felt it instinctively. And everything I ever saw him do or heard him say was completely appropriate to the occasion. Tara, a sister disciple, once remarked to me, "Every time I think I've understood him, I find he's much more than that." I didn't say so to her, but it astonished me that anyone could even think of understanding him. It seemed to me like trying to understand the ocean. His friendship for each of us was deeply personal, yet he was for us like a window onto infinity, inviting us to come outside and merge in vastness. I love my guru, as he himself wrote about his own guru, Sri Yukteswar, as the spoken voice of silent God. He was ever and is now more than ever my dearest and nearest companion. If I am right, I feel his inner smile. If I am wrong, I feel his inner encouragement to do better. He is on my side in every struggle against illusion. Could anyone be a better friend than that? This expresses, perhaps in a deep way, my personal feelings toward him, but he was much more than personal. He came with a mission. He came to bring to usher in a new age of understanding that all things are composed of energy. He had a worldwide mission which has only just started, and groups like this are the beginning of that in India. It used to pain me when I came to India in 1958, and I found the people in his own work not understanding who he was, thinking of his work as just another ashram. And how many of his disciples thought of him as the sort of little gurulet, a little guru doll, somebody that they could love personally, but they didn't understand his mission. He said to me when I came, and I have understood more and more what he meant when he told me, "You have a great work to do." My work has been like the work of St. Paul with Jesus Christ, to make him known to the world by explaining the profundity of what he brought and the breadth of what he brought. And I am grateful that I've had this role to play. All these 60 years that I've been with him, I have meditated on his life, on the meaning of his least gesture. And I found that in everything he said and did, there was a profound significance. It had, overall and above all, a message to mankind, which I think here in India we can clarify in a special way. As he said in his last words, and I was present when he left his body, his last words were to read his poem, "My India." And he closed his address by saying, reading from that poem, "I am hallowed, this body touched that sod." You all live here, you don't see that. But you know, we who come to India, when the plane lands, those who are sensitive feel the joy as if it were welling up out of the soil. I remember many years coming to India, and it was late at night, and I was in a bus going to Connaught Circus. There was nothing I could see visually. It was dark. All the people in the bus were Westerners. There was no visual impression, but I felt this joy welling up out of the ground, the joy left by countless thousands of years of great rishis. That is India, not the people who come and go. You're all tourists. You're here for a while, But that India, that power, tune into that. India's destiny is to be the guru of the world. And I have written a course. When I was in the hospital with double pneumonia a few years ago, and I was lying there practically unconscious, and this doctor came in, and he said to me, "Sir, can you help me?" I thought, doctors don't usually ask the patient to help them, especially when he's practically unconscious. He said, "Sir, I have a son in college in America, and I have many duties and many calls on me for financial nature." And he said, "I believe in yoga, and I believe in Sanatan Dharma. I believe in high principles, but how can I maintain my ideals when I have to think in terms of money? Sometimes I'm tempted to take shortcuts." And I said to him that I have found in my life, by adhering rigidly to the principle, yata dharma tata jaya, I have never sacrificed that principle, even when it looked as if ruin was staring me in the face. But I have found that I always came out victorious. And he looked at me, and I had to admit to myself that I was not at the moment an advertisement for success. And he didn't believe me. And the next day, I made the resolution to write a course, Material Success Through Yoga Principles. I highly recommend that course to everyone, because if Indians can learn that by dharma they will succeed, by never telling a lie, by never sacrificing their high principles, by adhering to these great truths, the greatest scripture I have ever read is the Bhagavad Gita. Read that. Study it. Live by it. It is something that will help you to fulfill a destiny that God has given you in this life, to bring dharma to the world. The more you do that, the more the world will look to you. I've been reading a very interesting book. It's called Up From Slavery, by a black man in America who was born into slavery and became greatly respected and founded a wonderful institution of learning, and showed himself in his life to be a great man. But he said that anybody who will prove to others that he has something and can do something they can't do will be accepted. You don't have to campaign for equality of any kind. Just give the world what it needs, and everybody will admire you. Success in business, success, money, success, and so on. Well, we've already got that in the West. We can respect you for having it. But if you give us success with honor, success with dharma, and if you help us to understand this deepest principle that God is in everybody and we should love him in everybody, the principle taught by Mahatma Gandhi. I was in India, not long after his death, just 10 years. And I saw then that some people were trying to live it. I feel it's less and less now. And I was talking to Abdul Kalam when Mr. Kartikeyan took me to visit him. And Abdul Kalam said to me, "What do you think of the direction that India has gone in?" And I said, "Obviously it is less spiritual today than it was back when I first came. But I said, this is a necessary phase, therefore I don't regret it. India has to claim its place alongside the great nations of the world. India is itself a great nation. Master said that someday India and America would join hands and lead the world on the path of spiritual and material efficiency. But I said, for now India has to go through this. Yet I appeal to you who have come here for spiritual satsang, to help your fellow men to understand, help your fellow Indians to understand that the greatest thing you can give to the world is what Gandhi represented, what the great rishis have represented, and what my great guru represented throughout his life, dharma, love and dedication to God, and dedication to serving God in your fellow man. God bless you. I have to add now that I am surrounded by a bunch of people who won't let me be with people because they say that if I get infected by any cold germs and so on because of my chemotherapy and everything, it won't be good. So they won't let me. And so I just say, as they said, as the saying is in the Arabian Nights, to hear is to obey. So I'm so happy to be with you all, but I must leave you. God bless you.
Thank you, Swamiji and Kartikayanji. I would like to invite Ruby to come to the stage, and we'll do a little presentation about our